Welcome to All the Pieces Matter, your weekly podcast and digital salon for Baltimore's insurgent do-gooders. I'm your co-host, Sharon Paley, along with Andrew Hazlett. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. We're going to bring in two special guests today, but of course we want to hear from you as well. So if you have comments on this week's podcast, please tweet us at All Pieces or give us a call at 410-429-0663.
Yeah, and we're today... We are very lucky to have some two cool people who hadn't met before in real life. Do you guys follow each other on Twitter?
I don't know.
All right, get your phones out
we'll
now.
We'll check that. But why don't you guys introduce yourselves, Robin?
Great. I'm Robin Stegman. I'm a director of design and development at Changing Media on Twitter at rsteggy. But you'll probably see a lot of Grumpy Cat stuff. We just finished a campaign to bring Grumpy Cat to Baltimore. I apologize in advance.
My name is Eli Puzon. I'm the Director of Preservation and Outreach for Baltimore Heritage. We're a nonprofit historic preservation advocacy organization. And I'm on Twitter at Eli Puzon, also at Be More Heritage. And I actually have a Frederick Law Olmsted impersonator account, but I don't.
What?
Oh,
I'm totally going to like get my park geek on with that. When I said what, I meant it because it was awesome. That was actually me really excited.
Time out 1 second.
Okay.
Sorry. What was the impetus for that?
At
Fred Olmsted.
Yeah, a certain project that I started last year. I wish I had kept up with it. And it's, I was doing, like, what is Fred Patrick Olmsted doing today?
Can you check the power on your mic?
I think the switch has to be pulled toward you.
Oh, then it was not on.
Oh, okay. Now try.
Is it working now?
Nice. Okay, that is much better. So actually, why don't we, to ensure a perfect product later, could we start again when you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Eli Puzon. I'm the Director of Preservation and Outreach for Baltimore Heritage. And we're a citywide nonprofit historic preservation advocacy organization. So I tweet for work at Be More Heritage and for myself at Eli Puzon.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on today, guys. And you know, I think the common thread that we were thinking about is that you're both using technology to further social good ends. That's a general kind of bucket that we like to throw ourselves into as well. It's a lot of what you've been doing for a few years now, Eli, is kind of helping to bring out Baltimore's history in digital form. And there's so much around us that you can literally trip over, fall into, etc. I don't think that there's a lot of, although this is a kind of a parochial, nostalgic town, there isn't a lot of knowledge about just how rich the history is here. Is that your experience?
I think that it's there's a lot of knowledge and there's a lot of folks who know a lot of history, but it's not always evenly distributed. And a lot of times I think that especially for a sort of more progressive do-gooder community, if you will, there's a lot of folks who have arrived in Baltimore from the DC area, for example, or haven't lived in the city as long. And I think those folks in particular, there's a lot of interest in learning more about the history of the city. And, you know, it's the city's over 200 years old. There's lots of history there. You could spend your lifetime trying to learn it and still have new things to discover.
Hmm. Yeah, and how do you interest somebody in this stuff? Maybe there's a latent interest or a potential connection to something that somebody's really concerned with. I think that applies for mission-driven nonprofits as well, of all kinds. How do you get your audience from point A to B, being caring about your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about that our organization has over the last decade or so shifted from just telling people that they should preserve historic buildings, you know, suing folks who want to tear them down, writing angry letters to the editor. I don't think we've ever chained ourselves before an oncoming bulldozer, but it would not be out of character. to moving to a place where more and more we really want to help everyone understand why we should preserve historic buildings and why revitalize historic neighborhoods. And part of that is the stories behind historic places in all the different kinds of ways. And so finding new ways of telling those stories, you know, both through traditional means like panel discussions or walking tours, but then also through some non-traditional means like our Explore Baltimore Heritage smartphone app, or back in February, we did a War of 1812 Valentine's project. I think it was some of them were like, my love for you is like a monument with a photo of the battle monument, or we had the my heart burns for you like the fires consuming Washington, D.C., see in the distance. So, so I do think that there's a different kinds of ways that we can, you know, experiment a little bit with new approaches.
Is that kind of stuff your experience also, Robin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is on like a digitization. I'm really interested. The Smithsonian just totally opened their archives to people to hand type and like digitize. And it's amazing how many people actually do care about history, but it's finding the way that like meeting them in the space they're at. For instance, I worked at the Woodrow Wilson for a Presidential Library for a really long time. And it was amazing because I would just come up across these like political cartoons about Woodrow Wilson that still had an amazing applicability to today. And we just very simply, you know, all you have to do is like scan and put it on Twitter and all of a sudden, like it becomes viral. Like, Dan Roderick's actually a couple weeks ago posted a photo of Woodrow Wilson at John Hopkins that I scanned like 3 years ago, but it still has this like playing power in imagination today. And I think that's what some of that digitization and getting things on social media really has the power to do.
I mean, there was just a conversation just while we're on NPR. I heard like a fragment of a conversation there yesterday where they were talking about Upworthy sort of like retitling a George Orwell piece and rerunning it, and how it just like went crazy viral, of course, because it's Upworthy. But this idea of, you know, almost like upcycling old content and making it relevant for today through, you know, social media and blogs and things like that. I think it's really fascinating that you see that playing out across like the arts and the humanities and historical preservation.
Yeah, which is funny because like upcycling new content is exactly what like revitalization of neighborhoods is, right? You have these like historic buildings that you're kind of retrofitting for modern needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so in general, not being sort of a guilt tripping scold you ought a adversarial stance, that does not work so well anymore, you'd say.
I think that there's a time and place for different strategies and different approaches, and so I would say that you know, there's a lot that there are a lot of forces stacked against the preservation of historic buildings in the way that we've organized our economy and the investment that pours into the surrounding suburbs, that we only really get you know, that we really need more investment in the historic core of our cities. And that's not just sort of rehabbing historic buildings, that's investment in green infrastructure, that's investment in bike infrastructure, it's investment in schools, so to make this a desirable and livable place for us all to be. And so, so I do think that there's but then you'd certainly run into places where there's, you know, with the Reed's Drugstore, for example, downtown, and that was mainly back in 2011, 2012, this story that very few people knew of its significance as very early sit-in site by an interracial group of activists from CORE and Morgan State University. And the plan was for the complete demolition of the building. And so I'd say we were certainly fairly adversarial in our approach to encourage some rethinking around the future of that building. And that's, mm-hmm. that's still we're still going to see what that's going to turn out as. The developer for that Superblock project, no longer part of the deal. So we'll see what the future of that and the other buildings in the Superblock still holds. So.
And what about like the sort of, you just touched on the green and sustainable part of this. I mean, is not recycling a building, quote unquote, the most green approach to building versus, you know, tearing something down and building something new?
The sort of classic quote is the greenest building is the one that is already there. And so and there's a lot of evidence to support that the environmental and economic benefits of rehabbing existing buildings, you know, significantly outweigh the benefits of tearing it down and starting new. So that's definitely, you know, I think one of the arguments that we use to help everyone understand what an asset historic buildings are. But, you know, I do think though that it's easy to get, you know, economic arguments are really critical and sort of environmental arguments are really critical. But I think it's also really great the way, you know, to return to what we were talking about just a moment ago, some of these, the increased availability of sort of digital sources and material has made the cultural heritage of the past something that like more people can participate in and engage with fully than I think maybe could before, and in really kinds of playful ways. I mean, I always think of like the sort of my 19th century boyfriend Tumblr. Have you guys seen this? It's sort of like various like handsome daguerreotypes. It's you know, like hipster Victorians, that kind of thing. And it's just like there's a really, and you know, you could maybe criticize those as just being a sort of hipster nostalgia, but I don't know. I think there's something really interesting going on with the way that we value the historic landscape, and it sort of gives a sort of special meaning to what it means to live in a city.
And I think it's really exciting that with digitization too, like some of that source material, like actually reading letters of people and things, are now available online in a way that used to be in like some collector's attic or some, you know, museum's attic. And I think that's really amazing when you see a lot of these digitization products, you know, coming out where people can actually like find letters that were written and like read diaries and see photos that beforehand were just stuffed in a box somewhere that unless you were a researcher, I remember like the curator talking about one time he was like researching this book and the last person to use the book was a monk 1,000 years ago. And just to say, you know, because so few people have access or care about that thing and they're finding these new audiences, which I think like having a Tumblr with like different people, like at least that's getting some new play that, you know, wasn't, you know, happening there.
Yeah, just by the way, I think is it my daguerreotype boyfriend?
That's probably it. Yeah.
It says, the subtitle is Where Early Photography Meets Extreme Hotness. Yeah. So for anyone interested in that, we'll make sure that's in the show notes at hackbaltimore.org. You know, it's like baiting a hook. I think the challenge obviously is getting people deeper in. And I think one thing that, that I've been using a lot, recently, and I know that, Sharon's husband has been into this also, is like ancestry.com. And just like genealogy in general has always been kind of an obsession, an addiction for people. But, you know, with, it's just pouring gasoline on the fire to add this, digital element to it. And, you know, ancestry.com, they certainly make you pay for the privilege. So hopefully there's going to be some more open alternatives in the near future. But it is totally absorbing to see the little notice of a hint and to find not just a mention of your relative in the 1910 census, but being able to actually look at the document and see the handwritten information about the profession, the house number, little details of people's lives start to come out. And that's really cool. That I mean, that's always been the great thing about primary sources or firsthand experience is getting this, sense. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You know, a little known fact, the well-behaved women seldom make history. A lot of people totally misunderstand what that meant, but it was about a historian, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and she was writing about Pilgrim women, and the only sources available were kind of gravestones that she was able to do, and it was really a lament that modern history was kind of forgot these well-behaved women. And for so much of our kind of historical knowledge, we haven't been actually looking at regular people down at the day. They've kind of been forgotten by history. And now with all of this available of materials that you can see, you know, a census record or something like that, that would be of, you know, nobody would have access to, you're now seeing these new stories come to life that, you know, we previously forgot and only talked about like the Napoleons of the world.
I mean, one of the my favorite projects that we've been working on this year at Baltimore Heritage is a project that we call Baltimore 1814. That's been basically since January 1st, a live blog of what was happening in the city day by day. I think every day, up through the present. And it's been about the War of 1812 and about the Battle of Baltimore, but it's also been about, you know, what's been going on for the lives of regular people. Like Johns Hopkins was down on Broadway Pier selling seed this spring, and, you know, his uncle left town and left him to manage the shop. His dad died this spring, you know, but there are other folks. There's, you know, a man who escaped from slavery in Upper Marlboro and joined the military here in Baltimore and was struck by a cannonball, you know, just a couple weeks ago, 200 years, and ultimately died. But the, you know, it's these different kinds of, to understand that, like, what makes history interesting and what makes historic places important isn't just one story. It's sort of like a whole bunch of stories layered on top of each other and sort of brought to life through, you know, words and images and, you know, experiences that we still have today.
And the things you find when you're searching for something else, I think that's what makes like those research. So there was a, I used to work in a historic renovation at 1001 Calvert. And at the bottom floor, there's a Mr. Lowndes like name on the door. And we're like, who's this Mr. Lowndes? So we went on kind of this like, you know, wild goose chase to find Mr. Lowndes and found this like one reference in an old Baltimore newspaper. But the story was about the increase of duels that were happening as a result of the election. Like calling for the city to find a plan to like control the duel, this like outbreak of duels because of people like getting in fights over local elections.
Yeah. I
guess there are things worse than newspaper comment sections.
Yeah. Yeah, if you thought Baltimore Sun, the Baltimore Sun comment section was racist today, go back to the like 1904 editorial board, and you'll find it will impress you with the character of the commentary.
Like,
well. I mentioned Scott. Has Scott been like spending hours, or is he over with this addiction to
genealogy? I think he's weaned himself off of it. But he was really deeply into it. And, I would say he was kind of annoyed that my family has been in Baltimore a really long time. Like it turns out I'm seventh generation Baltimorean, and he was very aggravated to find like very little information about his family. And it turns out like I'm from German stock and they were just way better record keepers than like, his family's kind of from like the Pale. So I don't know if it was like Poland or Russia, just depending on the week.
Oh yeah. I was just reading in Antero Pietella's book, Not in My Neighborhood, which traces that whole kind of history of racial segregation, that there was a German Jewish neighborhood that restricted Eastern European Jews from entering. So,
yeah, the Germans didn't like other, right.
Yeah, you could have been a Romeo and Juliet kind of situation.
No, I don't think his family was here all that long ago. But it's interesting to trace sort of even the migration of my Jewish family from like the, you know, the Lloyd Street area, just, and then they just basically like kept going northwest and like migrating, you know, like And I guess, you know, I don't, migrating through the redlined area where they were allowed to live, out to, you know, like Reservoir Hill and then out into Park Heights and then out, you know, eventually in the 50s when my dad was a kid that or a teenager, I guess, moving out of the city entirely. So, it is really interesting. It's really illuminating. I think there's this like, we're talking about, you know, regular people in and their place in history. It's like creating this, I don't know, digital Pompeii or something that like what's fascinating about Pompeii is like, it's not about, you know, some amazing palace or the Colosseum or whatever you, you know, can go around and see in other parts of Italy, but it's about, well, there's regular people who are like frozen in time and what a real, you get this real slice of life opportunity, right? And now we're getting that digitally.
Well, and it also opens up, like, as you know, with the example of, you know, your husband learning your family story and his family story through Ancestry.com, it opens up these, as in, you know, as digital tools have in so many different domains, opened up so many new opportunities for participation. I mean, I'm, you know, I mentioned earlier this Explore Baltimore Heritage project where we are sort of telling place-based stories about historic buildings and events through our app. And so we published a story recently on the narrowest row house in Baltimore. Are you guys familiar with this at all? Yeah. It's down in Federal Hill. I'd have to look up the address. And we don't know very much about it. Baltimore Heritage actually did give them the owners of the property an award back in the 1970s, which I didn't know. An award for being a skinny rehab, actually, back when they were doing the sort of dollar house rehabs of down in Baltimore. And so, but I didn't have a good photo of it. And so I posted on the Federal Hill sort of community Facebook group. I was like, hey, here's this story. Here's where it is. Can anyone swing by there and like take a photo and email it to me? And literally like 90 minutes later, I get an email from a woman who said, I walk past that house every day. I never really knew this story or, you know, I'm so like glad to learn it. And here's a good photo. And so it was just like this wonderful sense of connection, you know, that it was, it's not just about a story and it's not just about the past. It's about sort of, you know, folks being, interested and invested in their neighborhood and their community and sort of connected to one another.
Well, the Brew did an article recently that was sort of, you know, talking about the different styles of row houses in Baltimore. And I feel like ever since then, when I'm like walking around town, it's totally changed my perspective. Like I hadn't sort of thought about the evolution of the row house architecture. And now I could say, oh, I generally know what like half century that building was built in. But it's, you know, it's kind of the same thing, right? That the row house is, That's like the average Joe of Baltimore architecture versus, you know, the cathedrals and stuff like that. So I think it's fascinating to learn about those little gems like hidden around town.
The sort of one project that I've been thinking about for a couple months after the sort of BuzzFeed quizzes really blew up is I really want to have a "What row house are you?" quiz. It's like, I need, if anyone is interested in like some collaboration on this, it's sort of like, are you grand or modest, or are you tall or short? And just sort of like, because we do know, I mean, there is so much great research and writing that's been done on the Baltimore row house. I would love to like, here is the row house for you.
Yeah, I'm a 12-foot wide formstone covered,
yeah, exactly.
Formstone vacant, covered. Vacant with a sumac tree growing out of my head.
I hadn't quite thought about making that an option. I was thinking more, I don't know, a Renaissance revival or sort of like a daylight colonial revival.
You weren't planning to insult anyone the way Andrew has himself.
My geeky architectural historian is coming through here, perhaps too much.
No, like formstone monstrosity. I feel like that has. That would definitely be in there.
Yeah. For people who've had a lot of plastic surgery.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, or if you.
Ill-advised plastic surgery.
All of the questions in the same way that like Divine would have answered the question.
What is the John Waters quote that like Forbes shows the polyester of buildings? You know.
Well,
yeah,
but now it's illegal, right?
Oh yeah, is it?
Well, I know they're not permitting new formstone within historic districts. So I think that's there was some changes regarding the regulation. I don't know. I mean, formstone certainly had its day. And I think it's an important part of our cultural heritage. I wouldn't like to see it all go away, but I think there's a lot of virtue in the underlying brick as well. If right. we can find other ways of making sure that the house has the insulation that it needs.
Andrew and I like to walk around and find knockoff formstone houses because that's even more amusing to us than like, you know, formstone was obviously like the name brand, but then there's Kingstone and a couple other things I don't remember the name of. But you can go and you look on like the plaques on the lower, like under the window line of row houses, and you can see like what all the, you know, and you But they were trying, but they just couldn't get enough money together for formstone. But you do start to notice a difference even in the quality of the, you know, stamped cement or whatever it actually, I don't even know how they make it.
I think it is sculpted with a
well, the formstone was. Yeah. But some of it, no.
I know Elaine F., who is used to be the Maryland State folklorist and has done a tremendous amount of work around the sort of painted screens in Baltimore, just came out with a book last winter in the exhibition at MICA as well. But Elaine F. has talked about formstone as being part of this sort of domain of the sort of arts of row house living almost, which is a sort of idea that I love, that it's kind of like porch sitting and painting screens and scrubbing steps and sort of formstone. You know, I think that it's, again, there's a sort of a opening or an invitation. Is this nostalgia? Well, maybe not. I don't know. There's something really interesting to just think about, like what does formstone mean today? What do painted screens mean today in the age of sort of, you know, air conditioning or whatever else has all changed since those practices first came into existence.
I think we need like an art of row house living blog. That's about.
I mean, how to properly scrub your marble stairs.
I mean, but it's fascinating. I got a conversation. So I'm a transplant. I originally came from Lansing. So like row house living is very new to me, but the whole scrubbing your steps thing was like a totally novel thing to do. But it's a beautiful in a way that so much care is taken to the property outside of the front door in Baltimore that I think it's like it's a huge cultural thing. And I love the way that kind of architecture and the way that we kind of set up our living space does influence the way that we live our lives.
Yeah, I mean, it is this sort of interesting kind of like, you know, you've got your public space and your private space are so much closer together in so many neighborhoods of the city. And I do think that at its best, it encourages a kind of closeness of folks who live in the neighborhood that you can definitely see in like Patterson Park and South Baltimore and Bolton Hill. I mean, I think that, and Sowebo, I mean, there's a lot of parts of the city where that sense of, community is really still rooted in the, you know, seeing your neighbor sort of hanging out on a summer evening, like having a glass of wine on their front porch. And so it's, I think it's, you know, it's so the history stuff never stands alone. It's always, you know, the learning about the history of row houses like makes you appreciate them more, but without, you know, neighbors and porch sitting and everything else that comes with it.
I think it's also, It didn't ever strike me as like unique until I stopped living in Baltimore because I grew up here. That there are, you know, and it's not as true anymore, but it was still true when I was a kid that there was basically like a pub on every corner, and my dad would he'll be upset, but he used to take me into the, you know, we lived in Charles Village and he used to take me into the pub that was on the corner. And I got like a grilled cheese and, watched the Orioles game or whatever. And I think that's such a part of this like public private, you know, blended space that we're talking about. And I think it's not like typical America, that it's very like typically English, right? That like there's a little pub on the corner and everyone kind of goes down there and that's your living room. But I think that at least used to be part of Baltimore too. but it's kind of faded out.
Well, I think the virtue of being an old city too is that you're pedestrian created. I mean, that's, you know, again, being from like the Midwest and being the home of the car, like the thing that I notice when I come home is that it's set up for the fact that like your commercial spaces you drive to and you have larger properties because it doesn't, you know, you don't really need to walk to the next neighborhood. But the fact that, you know, you can bike 6 miles across Baltimore and be in a totally different neighborhood is incredible. Now, when we think about these things, about distance and, you know, making a kind of pedestrian biking friendly community, we already have that here.
Well, you know, in general, it seems to be there's been preservation through neglect in Baltimore, and that, you know, the last half century wasn't so great for the Baltimore economy. But that's meant that you know, this 19th century pattern of, you know, row houses, church, factory, all that's intact. I guess the question is, how much of it will continue to survive until there's the point that it can be repaired? You know, we with Hack Baltimore, we just did an event on vacant houses, and there's this very dedicated civic hacker, Shea Frederick, who works at Under Armour and has charted vacant houses across the city. He bought, under the Vacants to Values program, a house in the Greenmount West neighborhood. And in some ways, it's a great story for Baltimore that, you know, this young single guy is, you know, investing a lot of time and a fair amount of money in taking what's basically just the shell of a great old row house and turning it into a living space. But the measures he's had to go through are pretty, there's a lot of hoops to jump through, and there, not many people have the time and patience to basically demo, you know, a rotting interior themselves.
Or they don't have the financial wherewithal because mm-hmm. the city has pretty strict regulations about who can, you have to prove if you're buying through Vacants to Value that you have the financial ability to renovate the building, which I get because mm-hmm. We had Carol on here a couple weeks ago and we, mm-hmm. you know, and we know what happens when you just have absentee vacant owners, nothing good. Mm-hmm. So, but he was saying that he had to literally go down to the Vacants to Value office and fill out forms and then be told, no, that's not quite right, Mr. Frederick. And he filled them out 3 different times, and he's a pretty smart guy. Like, you start to wonder about ways that we can also make that more accessible and easier for people. And that there's a big opportunity for technology there.
Yeah.
And I think being able to, you know, you talk about absent owners, but also doing, a friend down in Arkansas doing a lot of work on these vacant properties that when people died and didn't have wills and now are owned by like 27 different people, researching and finding those 27 people to move those properties. Hmm. And I think trying to, you know, figure out what free space is and figuring out how to do that. Power and Dirt, one of the problems with that program is so oftentimes they're giving away parcels of land. The community then goes and says, oh, wait, that's so-and-so's dirt, you know, dirty lot. Why are you planning a farm on this lot? And the city, and so, but it's so complicated for the city to really go through and figure out who that belongs to that in, you know, time and kind of effort, they just don't. And so finding great ways to be able to like go through records and figure out those property also can help, make it easier for people to restore those spaces.
Well, are all of these kind of wonders of Baltimore history and architecture, are they gonna survive?
Well, I mean, a few minutes ago, I was completely dismissing the importance of thinking about economics in favor of culture. They hear me backtracking. I mean, I think that there's a lot of encouraging trends in a variety of ways. I mean, I similarly would say that the increasing number of people under the age of 35 who are choosing to live without a car or with access to a car through Zipcar or something like that creates, you know, huge opportunities for the neighborhoods in and around central Baltimore, where just the bones of the neighborhood as a 19th century community that grew up around, you know, some of them by horse-drawn omnibus even before we had the electric streetcar coming in the 1890s. Those are great neighborhoods to bike around. That's where, I mean, I live in Mount Vernon. I bike everywhere, and I think it's the best way to get around the city. And so I think some of those kinds of things will really help change the market and opportunities and enable it to be a lot more feasible for small developers and private developers to come in and begin rehabbing a lot of the vacant properties. I also think, though, it's important a lot of times to look at these questions regionally. It's that we are still, even as we are all acknowledging the importance of revitalization, or many of us are acknowledging the importance of revitalization, the importance of equity, the importance of dealing with the issues surrounding climate change, for example, we're still seeing a lot of investment going into suburban communities and sort of sprawl-oriented kinds of growth. And so we really need to get a handle on the public policies and market forces that still kind of encourage that investment, so that we can bring those dollars back into the city and really create a better set of incentives for mixed use residential and commercial development that's going to use our existing building stock to make a better city for us all to live in.
Well, that's a good high note to begin to wind things up. And we do want to let you guys get back to this important work that you're each doing. But are there things coming up in particular that you'd like to plug or mention?
I would love to invite everyone for are the one of the partners who organize an annual unconference for around public history, historic preservation, and cultural heritage. It's going to be on Friday, October 10th at the Maryland Historical Society. Registration is filling up, so I hope there are still spots open when this show is airing. The other thing, though, that I'll mention that I'm sure there'll be, it's a more the merrier kind of thing, is that this year we're partnering with That Camp Games, Unconference on Technology and the Humanities. And that's going to be down in the Baltimore Harbor Hotel on Saturday, October 11th, and Sunday, October 12th. And that Sunday morning from 9 to noon, we're going to be doing a Baltimore historic game jam. Inviting designers and developers, educators, scholars, historians, anyone who's interested in the intersections of games, learning, local history, and just wants to get more involved with those kinds of things, come out and sort of, you know, play with a group of like-minded folks for a couple hours on Sunday, October 12th.
Cool.
Great. I don't have anything to plug.
Sorry. I want like an Oculus Rift that I can walk around the city with and see what it used to look like program it to like H.L. Mencken or
yeah, just a time travel. That's basically what you're asking.
I'm asking for time travel,
but it's a lot more plausible now than it once was.
I also think there is an opportunity for Zip Horse now that you mention it, Eli.
Zip Horse. Well, have you seen? I mean, I first thought. Have you seen the? It's in Hungary now. They're taking abandoned buildings and they're running this game where you have to get out of the building. So it's like this entire puzzle game where there's like clues and stuff, and then they take like teams of like 10 people. And they lock them in the building and say, like, figure out how to get out.
That is completely terrifying to me.
Yeah. And, like, started in Japan. It's like puzzle rooms or something. I heard about this. It's really interesting.
And like people pay a lot of money for it. And I think this is our next way to use vacants in Baltimore.
Puzzle row houses.
Yeah, exactly. Wire themed puzzle row houses. Oh, and we'll get all of the tourists.
The live action role-playing game.
That's right.
Wow. Well, why don't you share some of your links and say your Twitter handles again, guys?
So I'm at rsteggy, Yeah, and I won't be tweeting all about Grumpy Cat.
No, you're done with Grumpy Cat?
I mean, the campaign is done to bring Grumpy Cat to Baltimore.
Is Grumpy Cat coming to Baltimore?
I think that's what everyone wants to know.
We have fierce competition from Berkeley and Milwaukee and Des Moines, but we all know we're better than those cities. We won't know until next week. But
I've never been to any of those other
Baltimore,
places.
I think, has a really fighting chance. So we might have a Grumpy Cat visit and... that it would be pretty awesome.
Is there really only one Grumpy Cat?
There is.
Isn't there just like a whole bunch of cats who look like have that mashed up face thing? And
I mean, if there were, I think they could make a lot of money. And there might actually be new potential for a cat plastic surgery business because of the way that, like, you know, in order to like make money off the cat, I keep telling my cat to look stranger so that I can quit my job and become my manager.
Wow. Oh, I confess I had to Google it, but it looks really funny.
You've never heard of
Grumpy Cat? You've never heard of Grumpy Cat?
No, I've heard of it, I think. But now
Yeah. Oh, speaking of the 19th century.
So you'll have to see the BuzzFeed article about 23 reasons why Grumpy Cat has to come to Baltimore. It's pretty amazing.
When we were adopting a cat from Barks this past spring, I photoshopped Grumpy Cat's head onto a portrait of Oliver Hazard Perry, who's one of the naval heroes of the War of 1812, and labeled it Oliver Hazard Perry. But we ended up adopting a female cat, so I didn't get my way with our cat War of 1812 pun themed name. So
it's really come full circle, because in a previous episode we talked about how the internet was apparently literally created to share cat photos. One of the first images shared via the internet was a cat. So I guess that's just the way it is. That's a tradition worth preserving.
There you go.
Maybe we can, when Grumpy Cat comes, we'll take her on a tour of like historic.
Oh, that would be excellent. And we'd do a cat oriented walking tour.
Yeah, but she'll just be grumpy. She'll be like, not impressed.
That's right. And like every time you have to fight to save a city, the way you get with young folks is you're like, yeah, but Grumpy Cat was there. And they're like, whatever you need to do.
Put a little plaque. Chip off the one that says George Washington slept here.
Exactly.
Hang up the one that says Grumpy Cat was here.
Grumpy Cat frowned here.
All right, well, I'm going to put links to all of this in our show notes. And if you want to listen to this again or share it with a friend, you can do so via hackbaltimore.org, and you'll find the All the Pieces Matter heading there. And you can follow us at All Pieces on Twitter. And again, you can leave a message that if it's polite enough, we will play it on the air. At 4:10.
Meaning we don't do blue.
Yeah,
so keep it clean, people.
Yeah, we don't work blue. We're trying to hold out for like major corporate sponsorship. So
no, that's
we're gonna keep
to
it clean, kids. But do give us a call. It's
429.
I'm sorry. Let's start that again. 410-429-0663. That number again is
410-429-0663. That's beautiful.
Now, how are they going to remember it if I can't? But all right.
All right, we'll get a better phone number.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, it's all at hackbaltimore.org. I'm at Andrew Hazlett on Twitter.
And I'm at Sharon_Paley on Twitter. And you can email us, Andrew or Sharon at hackbaltimore.org. I'm sure you could just find us stumbling around town too. I'll have an Oculus Rift on. That's how you'll know it's me. And a really, really long extension cord.
Well, thanks again, guys. And we'll see you around.
Great. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.